Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 31st, 2010. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. As we move into the crucial August-September conjuncture, the time we have to reverse the disintegration of the global economy is getting shorter. As Lyndon LaRouche has forecast, it could go at any time. There's really nothing holding it up. And we see daily the signs of an accelerated corrosion. When you look at what's happening to cities and states, the collapse of infrastructure, the shutdown of police and fire and teaching, education, you look at the increase in the number of bankruptcies and foreclosures, and even with the highly doctored figures that we get on unemployment, it's clear that 30 million or more people who would wish to have full-time employment are being denied that right. And then every day there are new proposals to save funds by denying medical care to the sick, the poor, the elderly. And at the same time, the British puppet, President Obama, continues to assure Wall Street and his City of London controllers that an unlimited amount of bailout funds will flow to them to cover their worthless financial assets, their toxic debt. In the last week, Lyndon LaRouche has added a new initiative to the leading outstanding proposals he's placed on the agenda, a plan for what he called a TVA of the 21st century, a Tennessee Valley Authority-type plan from Franklin Roosevelt called NWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance. Once Obama's been removed from office, we can then implement the policies that will enable us to dig our way out of this dark age. These include primarily a Glass-Steagall regulatory principle, without which you won't have the banking or the credit system to fund any kind of recovery. We have to put the banks through bankruptcy reorganization, and then from the federal government, generate credit for productive economic activity. And a significant amount of this credit will go to fund NWAPA, along with the Moon and Mars mission, as principal projects which can not only reverse the collapse today, but set us on a course for the next two, three, four generations to put behind us the idiotic thinking of British monetarist policy which led us into this collapse. Now, today on the program, I'm going to be joined by two members of the basement team to discuss NWAPA, in its broadest sense, the new definition of infrastructure that's come out of Mr. LaRouche's work with the basement. I'll be joined by two old friends. And when I say that, they're still both pretty young, but they are old friends of mine, Cody Jones and Ouyang Teng. So Cody and Ouyang, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harley.
Now, let's start with the obvious question, and either of you can pick it up, or the obvious questions, I should say. What is NWAPA? And why is it necessary to have a project of this scope to reverse the accelerating economic collapse? Cody, you want to start?
Yeah, I can begin. And Ouyang, you can jump in any point. But essentially what NWAPA is that it represents fundamentally an identity shift for the United States and for the world. What we're talking about is a massive infrastructure project to take a large amount of runoff water, which typically is lost out of up in the Alaska region into the oceans, and to divert it down through Canada, the United States, and into the northern part of Mexico to create the conditions for massive irrigation, water generation, create the potential to support new cities and the building of nuclear power plants along the way. And the basic idea is that in doing this, you're shifting the entire potential of the biosphere and the noosphere by creating the conditions to be able to support more life at a more energy-intensive way. And really, in doing that, you're going to start to energize the entirety of the U.S. population and economy, starting at the highest level. I mean, as Lynn has made the point, is that you don't want to... This isn't just a simple jobs creation program, you know, where you're just telling people, hey, here's a way to get a paycheck for you, buddy. A paycheck does not necessarily mean a productive job. what this is that it's starting to put potentially millions of people to work in productive activity, changing the overall potential of the planet to support human life, to support biotic life, but starting at the highest level of engineers and scientists, that you're taking the highest level of unemployed layers of our workforce, our unemployed engineers that were formerly employed in things like aerospace, NASA, other high-level engineering occupations and scientists, and you're mobilizing them initially to get them excited about this project and putting them to work. So you're putting the highest level of skill to work in the United States, which is then going to be used to pull up the rest of the population into this massive project to really fundamentally transform the identity of our nation, the direction of our economy, and to then create the potential for a real linking up and development across things like the Bering Strait Tunnel for the development of Eurasia, Trans-Siberia, and ultimately to create the conditions for the development of Africa through similar types of irrigation and water development projects.
Cody, let me come back to
fundamental shift.
Yeah, let me come back to something that you said right at the very beginning, that it would be an identity shift, that this is not about copper wires and tractors and pipelines and things of that sort, although it is technically. But the identity shift is what you and Mr. LaRouche are emphasizing. Now, how do you see that identity shift? I know you went through some of these questions just now in terms of global infrastructure, but what does it mean for the average person who's sitting there right now looking at the economy saying, what the hell, where is their hope?
Yeah, well, fundamentally what it means is that your life is going to have some meaning for the future. That in a certain sense, you can locate a sense of immortality in your contribution and productive activity through this project, and what that's going to mean for creating then a higher level potential for the next generation and the generation beyond that. And recognizing that this itself is still only a foundation for the even higher mission, which is to continue onto the industrialization of the moon and the eventual colonization of Mars. So it's an identity shift that says that myself as an individual, my family, my nation is not committed to just the bookends between life and death, but is committed to what I do while I'm here in a productive way, which is going to contribute to an indefinite development of future generations, you know, beyond even the Earth. And so it's really a shift in that kind of sense of what the meaning of your life is through this kind of infrastructure project.
Now, Ouyang, you're working...
Go ahead. I was just going to say, in looking at some of the original reports, for example, the Senate report, the Senate committee report from the 1960s where they reviewed the project, even then, in relatively dry language, they still refer to the fact that this is planning on a scale of 30 years, which itself is a little bit shocking, you know, given if you take the absurd extreme of today of, you know, maybe allocating money for, you know, 1 year of temporary relief work or something, which isn't even creating real jobs under the stimulus or something like that. But the idea that there was a time where national policy took into account investments of a generation or more, I would say that, you know, LaRouche's approach to this is a slightly longer arc of looking back, redefining infrastructure from the standpoint of certain phases of human development, each of which represent an underlying principle of what should become the idea of infrastructure. He's referred to the movement of civilization, first the creation of maritime civilizations, based on an understanding of the astronomical cycles, so that civilization's power, its the idea of transportation over the oceans, defining sea lanes, began as a derivative power from understanding these long-term astronomical cycles. That was a sort of a form of organization of society. You had successive advances through, you know, river-based riparian cultures, and then accelerating forward to the 19th century in the United States, really a new breakthrough in terms of inland development, the ability to actually take the territory as a whole away from the coast and bring it into a higher state of potential population density through rail, through canals. And so on the one hand, you have had in the history of human development, including an interesting case in the history of human agriculture, where you know the question of soil erosion has been a long-term problem in terms of you know the ability to support a civilization. And so alternatively, the idea of what kinds of infrastructure has to be done to even maintain the soil. These questions have been implicit in the organization of society for all of human history, essentially, at least all of recorded history. And so I think Nawapa is both, one, a continuation of this sort of upward development, but it's qualitatively different in the sense that it becomes a self-conscious organization of this sort of the totality of man's power with respect to the biosphere as a complete system. I mean, even just the scale of the project itself is larger than anything else that's been done in terms of, you know, a continental-wide management system. And that from that standpoint, then you begin to move into the domain of, it implicitly launches the conscious management by mankind of the development of the planet as a whole and every facet of that. Because the hydrological cycle, maybe we can, you know, we'll discuss this more as we go on, but the hydrological cycle itself, so-called water cycle, is really just a subsumed feature of the development of the biosphere as a whole. And so that's really what we're tapping into. That's really what we're plugging into by channeling this runoff, irrigating new land, and you know effectively altering the weather patterns for the entire continent.
Well, I'd like to get into those kinds of questions in a few moments, including the relationship of this to a shift in thinking to the standpoint of Vernadsky's approach to the interrelationship of the three phase spaces. But I have a couple of questions I think we have to get to first, because we probably have some listeners out there who have already been blown away saying, well, how much is this going to cost? How can you do it? How do you push it through politically? Let me just tell our listeners that they can ask questions by sending your emails into radio@larouchepub.com. And we'll try to get to your questions. So it's radio@larouchepub.com. So, Cody, let me go to you, because let's put aside for a moment the issue of cost, because one of the things I do want to discuss is this shift in thinking of what a real economy is in line with LaRouche's conception of infrastructure. But let's put that aside for a moment, because we know that's one of the arguments people use. You can't, who's going to pay for it? Where's it going to come from? Why would anybody oppose a program like this? When you're talking, as Ouyang did, about millennia long developments in terms of the shift from maritime cultures to inland cultures to the potential now for an interstellar culture. Who would oppose this and why?
Well, it's opposed by those who locate their identity in the tradition of Zeus. I mean, this goes back to that historical fight that Mr. LaRouche often cites, which is the Promethean fight for fire, for man, against the oligarchical tradition of Zeus. That you do have forces out there largely centered in the Wall Street faction in the United States, in the Venetian faction in London, and Europe broadly. But it's this grouping which we've often identified as the Inner Alpha group most recently, who says we don't want development for man. They recognize that more people is going to demand more development. Development requires technology. To develop and promote technology means people have to be educated. They've got to get a classical education. They have to understand science. They need to understand how the universe around them works. Now, people in that condition, with that quality of education and identity, are not susceptible to being enslaved. They're not going to allow themselves to be treated and herded around like cattle. And so there are very powerful, although very stupid and not very truthful forces out there who oppose this kind of project precisely because what it demands in a shift in the identity of the United States and the world is fundamentally against what they intend, which is massive depopulation, a continued looting of the raw material resources of places like Africa, and a general dumbing down and enslavement of the human population to meet their oligarchical desires.
And Cody,
now,
I assume
that takes the form of Barack Obama.
I was just going
to say,
let's talk about the Zeus faction for a moment, because we heard some things out of President Obama this week, which, as Lyndon LaRouche said, we have to make the hard statement that our first black president, in practice, appears to be an anti-black racist. And his comments, whether it's on Charlie Rangel, on being a mongrel race, on shifting education, clearly he's with that faction. But when you say the Zeus faction, is this what you're talking about, the people who would halt production and instead put people back in a form of mental and physical slavery?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think indicative of this, and as it relates particularly to this NWAPA project, is something maybe Ouyang can speak on with this recent presidential directive about the non-transfer of waters from basin to basin.
Yeah, it is funny. It's something I think people should think about. I mean, one is, as LaRouche has made clear, you know, the number one reason Obama has to be out is that with Obama in office, you don't have Glass-Steagall. You have Wall Street in control. You have this sort of dark age faction in control. And without Glass-Steagall, it's not even worth talking about NWAPA or any other project. But the other thing is for people to think about, you know, Obama is terrible, but he's not just generically bad. He's not just generically evil. It's almost as if he's taken every specific project that's necessary for the advancement of the country. You know, take his initiative on Constellation, shutting down manned space in the United States. And the timing was interesting, right? It was a few months after we had launched our campaign around Mars colonization. Then you have this thing within the last couple of weeks of the creation of this National Ocean Council, which boiled down to its essentials is effectively outlawing NWAPA. They say, we're going to turn over the control of our oceans, our Great Lakes, our waters, the United States waters, over to the dictates of the World Wildlife Fund, and prevent any development, and they explicitly say prevent any interbasin transfer of water. So it's almost as if, you know, Obama's intuition, he's got this sort of otherworldly intuition for exactly the kinds of projects we need, and his compulsion is to go exactly at those projects and destroy any possibility for action.
So you think it's that kind of preconscious process as opposed to someone calling him saying, here's your list of projects to destroy?
He's predisposed to exactly what his controllers put him in for. I mean, it's sort of the case that we, you know, see in California. You've made the point, Harley, on Schwarzenegger. He was chosen because, you know, he had the stomach to impose austerity. Obama is predisposed, as Lynn said, because he's a failed personality. It's not that he's just immoral, he's amoral. He's predisposed to sort of attack anything that would represent any kind of real value, almost as if it's a personal insult to his own sense of worthlessness.
Hmm. Well, let me get to the economic side of this for a moment then, because we have, as Cody and Ouyang both mentioned earlier, and by the way, you're listening to Cody Jones and Ouyang Teng, who are two leading members of LaRouche's basement team, which is engaged in scientific and economic transformations along the lines of the great breakthroughs in the past related to Kepler, Leibniz, Carl Friedrich Gauss, Riemann, and so on. That tradition in science, which has been the tradition, which has allowed for the incredible expansion of the power of the human race on the planet, which is what is being eroded right now. Now, part of that is in the economic realm, the thinking and economy, where someone would say it's not cost-effective to move water. So on the one side, you have the World Wildlife Fund freaks who argue that this somehow violates Mother Nature. But then you have a whole school of economics which says, no, it's better to share the scarcity than to spend the money on this. So how do you address, what's the problem in economics and how do you address it?
Well, I'd say it's the whole idea that, and it, in fact, it's the same idea that the environmentalists use. It's ultimately that human beings have to deal with scarcity. Is that's going to be the principle of organization of society, is how do you distribute an increasing scarcity. And that's the presumption which they use to sort of, shut off or control the debate. I mean, one useful point to make is that we don't have a water shortage. Not only because we've got a massive amount, and people have noticed, we've got a decent amount of water in the world's oceans, which can be desalinated on large scale. But really, the hydrological cycle, the movement of water, you know, that doesn't, it's not as if that's shrinking. It's not as if we're getting less water on the world. It is largely a question of distribution. If we take, you know, what NWAPA targets, it's the fact that you have a huge portion of freshwater precipitation and runoff in a virtually unpopulated area of the planet. And diverting a relatively small amount of it, less than 20% or about 20% of it, could, you'd increase the U.S. If we're just talking about the U.S., you'd increase the U.S. supply by a good 20% right there. So there's a sort of an idea that, you know, human beings are sort of stuck with some given conditions within which they have to work. The idea of using this project as a basis for opening up not only the water development per se, but being a trigger for the development of the Eurasian land bridge, the Bering Strait project that's into Siberia, of connecting the Darien, through the Darien Gap into South America, using this as a keystone for initiating science driver projects on fusion technology and on a Mars colonization project, is that you're really redefining the principle of economics to say that it's human beings not responding to the limitations of their environment, but reorganizing their environment. So it's linked. The idea is the same. It's the same fallacy that both the environmentalists and the monetarists apply to the question.
That's really important, because then you get to the so-called bottom line types, and we run into them every day. Someone says, well, what's the bottom line? It's going to cost so many billions of dollars, and we don't have the money. How do you answer that, Cody?
Well, I'd say the bottom line really is just the brown streak that's in their underwear, because they're scared shitless of really thinking and challenging themselves on what real economics and what a real human identity is. I mean, this is why Lynn makes such a point to emphasize the thinking of Riemann and people like Vernadsky. Because as Ouyang had mentioned, it's not just a question of figuring out how to better spread the wealth or how to better allocate a fixed amount of resources, but recognizing that the unique quality of the human mind is that it has a willful, creative quality which can intervene through a discovery to transform the entire phase space of how your economy is operating, that you introduce new principles which themselves create and define what your resource base is going to be, which actually intervene to change the biosphere in which you exist, to actually bring the biosphere up to a higher level of organization to better support not only life in general, but human beings. I mean, one thing we're looking at is that with the NWAPA plan, you have the potential, just even initially, to create irrigation in the United States alone equivalent to almost four times what you have in the Central Valley. As people know, the Central Valley was and to some extent continues to be the most productive agricultural land in the world. And we now have the potential to create initially four times that amount of agricultural development through this NWAPA plan. And in doing so, you'd be transforming the Great American Desert, the large arid regions west of the 20-inch rainfall line, into productive agricultural lands, also forested areas, which now you've created the potential to sort of start to recycle that water into the atmosphere to create clouds, new kinds of weather systems, to cool the overall temperature of that region by up to 3, some say even 7 degrees, changing the whole weather patterns, not only of that region, but potentially North America and maybe even the globe, particularly if you start doing this in places like Africa and elsewhere. So you're actually transforming the entire planet to actually make it more habitable, capable of supporting more people at higher standards of living, and sort of taking an already evolving biosphere and bringing it to an even higher state of evolution than the biosphere and life alone could achieve without the intervention of man. And that kind of thinking, that's what real economics is. Real economics is anti-entropic growth and development, not just bean counting and figuring out how to, you know, reallocate a bunch of worthless goods from China or something.
And so this goes against the Zeus-Malthusian view that there are limits and therefore we have to just redistribute the shortages. And I want to come back to that a little bit later in terms of raw materials, because I know, Ouyang, you've done some work in particular on this. But let me just take up another. We got a question from an email on the, basically, the, I think one of you brought up the Bering Straits. The question asks, would the NWAPA project run alongside high-speed rail lines? What are we talking about in terms of the, beyond just the water transfer, in terms of the impetus this will give to global infrastructure projects?
Well, we're in the process right now. I mean, we have a whole team working on this. Part of, we have some people who are working specifically on updating what the bill of materials actually is, because you have what's required for the project itself, that is the dams, distribution, etc. But then exactly that point, the whole idea that, number one, you're going to be transforming the entire productive capability of the United States, which, you know, isn't going to do you a whole lot of good if you have no means of getting the increased production, if it just rots on the field because you have no rail to carry it anywhere. So it's going to require a massive upshifting of rail, of electrified rail, of high-speed rail. Best case scenario would be maglev rail as well. It's going to require new power systems, nuclear power, both for the infrastructure, you know, the water distribution, some of the pumping, in addition to the hydropower that's being collected. But really what we're talking about, and this is, I think, where people have to think, you know, use their imagination, is we're talking about creating the cities that should have been created in the United States back in the 19th century. We're talking about populating, you know, a good section of the country which has remained undeveloped since particularly Teddy Roosevelt imposed, you know, this environmentalist policy of no development on the western land. So we're actually want to think about the sort of creation of new population centers that are organized around production, where you're going to have rationally planned housing around public parks. You're going to have rationally planned industry around central residential areas. You're going to have rationally planned agriculture surrounding that region. And so you're going to actually have Renaissance cities that will be the sort of lasting legacy of this kind of project. I think people start thinking in that way, that you're not just redistributing some material. You know, you're not just redistributing water from one place to another, but you're actually sort of reshaping the cultural and population dynamics of the entire country. I mean, because you take a flight over the United States, and you know, most of the flight you're going to be staring at empty, barren land.
I think in keeping with that idea of repopulating or populating the West with beautiful cities, we should probably put a very large fence around the city of Las Vegas and charge admission to have it as a kind of clinical study of what happens when a population goes crazy over money and the goddess Fortuna. Because this is one of the largest sources of water use in the West, is to maintain Las Vegas, so suckers from all over the country can come and give up their money.
Yeah, the only vestige of Wall Street we want to have is those fake Manhattan buildings they have in Las Vegas.
Now, let me take this one step further on the economy, because I had a discussion with Lyndon LaRouche yesterday, which I think was also carried out in his interaction with you in the basement, on the importance of the states of California and Washington. and that these would be both beneficiaries of NWAPA, but also economic drivers for the whole nation. And as I understand it, one of the things he's talking about with this is that both of you sort of cut your teeth with the LaRouche Youth Movement in the fight against Schwarzenegger in California, where we saw the remnants of an agro-industrial infrastructure state that had been built up largely after World War II, with defense sector, with machine tool production, aerospace, very, as Cody mentioned before, the Central Valley, the Imperial Valley, major infrastructure projects, and so on. And then in Washington State, besides the port in Seattle, you have Boeing. That these are two states that have had a significant destruction of that kind of human potential, that kind of engineering and skill capability. So how would you see us revitalizing these two states to make them drivers for the national economy, as California definitely was in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mr. LaRouche has made the point that California has probably right now up to perhaps 100,000 idle skilled engineers and other types of people with manufacturing capabilities. I mean, I know just from in organizing Los Angeles, you know, despite the image that it has of just a Hollywood freak show or gangbanging between rival gangs, you know, crack dealing gangs, that the reality of Los Angeles is that it at one time was a real industrial city. It still has a lot of small machine tool shops. It's also got a lot of idle capacity. Now, you can say the same for places like Oakland, which O'Young can speak more to. But all up and down California and also in Washington, you have tons of machine tool shops, idle industry, engineers from places like Parsons and elsewhere, who NASA, JPL, who worked on things like not only the space program, but were part of the Central Valley development projects, the water development projects, were part of these massive industrial projects all up and down the coast there and the inland, who are now idle, who have skills, who have knowledge, but are just being left to rot. And so you revive that base. You've got a base of intelligent, skilled workers who are going to understand what this program means. They'll have an intuitive sense of where it's going and how to apply it. And what Mr. LaRouche is saying is that that's the person you want to speak to. You mobilize and organize that layer of the population. They'll get it right away. And then they'll be the ones who will be able to pull up the rest of the population to get on board, because the rest of the population will look to them as leaders, as people who have intelligence on these matters.
So, Cody, this layer is where you would find what you might call the project managers, who could immediately grasp the scope of the plans and start putting them together. I believe what Lynn said yesterday is that this sector of the population could be put to work tomorrow if we had the bill passed today.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So this is what's on the agenda if we can get into the post-Obama era.
Right.
Now, I'd like to take this a little bit further, because I know the two of you have been working on a number of ideas that may not be that familiar to the listeners of the program, but really are going to be the defining characteristic of this kind of breakthrough, because we're really not just talking about building some projects. Let me just start with you, O'Young, if you could. When Lynn talks about this question of the assertion of the power of the noosphere over the biosphere, and the fact that you have a kind of creative development in the three existing phase spaces, what are the implications of that kind of scientific approach for taking up a project of this type?
I mean, I'd say that it's actually essential, because you know, the fact that we haven't done it, people should remember that in the 60s, there was a real core. The aside from the, you know, Cold War aspect, it tends to get played up. The core of the U.S. space program originated amongst the German pioneers like Kraft-Ehrke, who developed a whole philosophy. Ehrke called it the extraterrestrial imperative. This is what these guys were working on in the 20s and 30s. This is what they brought in to the United States, which became the nucleus of the Apollo project, was really an idea of this is the first step in man's colonization of the solar system. this is a necessary evolutionary step. We've now got the technology to begin the concrete process of moving off the planet. And in the process, actually realizing the identity of the human race is, you know, not sort of, not stuck on, in one place, like the image of a peasant who spends their entire life in one village. You know, we can take the analogy of that, maybe the railroad coming through and someone having for the first time the ability to actually leave their town or their little village. Similarly, mankind is not meant to be stuck in, you know, sort of one shrinking part of the planet or one shrinking, you know, surface of one planet. So that was there. So the idea that we have now, that what has to drive our activity into the future is a self-conscious understanding of the fact that the system that we partake in is cosmic in nature. And I mean that at a very concrete level. You know, you go out and you have a certain kind of climate that you experience. That's to a large degree determined by cosmic phenomena, cosmic rays, relative orientation of the sun to the earth, the relative energy output of the sun. So, you know, you're really at no time able to isolate yourself from that system. So it would be insanity to say that you're somehow going to try to prevent the movement of the human species off the planet. Now, the biosphere as a whole is shaped, is organized by these cosmic phenomena for the purpose of increasing the rate and the qualitative transformative capability of the system as a whole. That's been what you might call the infrastructure principle of the biosphere, to create the preconditions at different stages of its development.
So you're saying that this is something which actually exists in an implicit form, that creativity, this kind of transformation, exists implicitly in the three phase spaces.
Yes, and it's something that Vladimir Vernadsky emphasized, that, you know, the biosphere is, it's a structured medium which acts as a whole. The, you know, humanity is is both an expression of that process, but subsumes it, because now we have the ability to actually direct where it goes. We can mass produce, you know, plant life. We can increase the biomass of the planet. We can increase the specific kinds of energy flux density that's applied at different regions of the planet through plant life and other things. We can mass produce even species. You know, that's ultimately what's implied in these kinds of projects. And so,
just to come back to what you were talking about earlier, this is what you would say with the proof of this would be the advance of mankind from the maritime culture to the development of continental cultures and so on. That's actually a proof of this principle of creativity.
Yeah, it's almost an unconscious transmission over long waves of culture, of a gradual upshift in our identity. The key now is to make that self-conscious, to actually wield it at the level that we're capable of doing through the instrumentality of the nation state. You know, that's why it's the fight over Glass-Steagall is no different in terms of taking control of, you know, national and international economic policy than the fundamental question about how we're going to organize the biosphere at the level of, you know, scientific principles.
Well, Cody, would you say that this then is a way in which you're actually increasing the power of the noosphere through these kinds of discoveries of principle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're creating a potential to support more people at a quality of life which is then capable of providing them the ability to get the levels of education and investigation into principle, which then will produce a continued and higher density increase in discoveries amongst those people. That, I mean, one way that, the way Lynn is really looking at this thing is that this, even the WAPA itself, as not just a project for North America, but as a project for the world, which combined with the Bering Strait project encompasses the entire world for development down through Africa, but that this is really just a testing ground for figuring out what really do we need to know in order to be able to take this kind of development onto Mars for the colonization of Mars, where the challenge is much greater, where you don't have, you've got one-third the gravitational potential, a very different electromagnetic field. You've got an atmosphere which is very different. So none of the conditions which we sort of came into here on Earth with an atmosphere, with oceans, with plant life, etc., none of that exists on Mars. So to be able to get a greater depth of understanding of what we would have to do to transform Mars, we're gaining that insight through what we're seeing we're capable of doing with this NWAPA project and seeing what are the means by which you really increase the energy flux density of the planet through the activity of chlorophyll managed by man through things like the irrigation projects of NWAPA. So you're gaining a greater insight into what really is the nature of man, that the identity of man is, as Ouyang was saying, a self-conscious intervention into the biosphere to increase the potential of the biosphere, which then creates the foundation for an increase in the noosphere and its ability to propagate and grow, all for the purpose of understanding with greater depth what's going to be required to be able to do this at a transfinite level on another planet where everything is different.
So this brings us back to what you said at the beginning about the shift in identity, because one of the problems we're having with the organizing for this is that some of our organizers are trying to make a linear connection. Well, once we get the idea of great projects again, then it would be natural to have the next great project be the colonization of Mars. But Mr. LaRouche, and you're saying something fundamentally different, it's not just a question of increasing the scalar magnitudes of the activity. It really is a question of changing the quality of thinking that goes into economic and scientific deliberation.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as Lynn always makes the point, the universe as a whole is, one, it's a system. It's interconnected. There's nothing in the universe which is separate and set off from any other part of the universe. So it's one connected system, and it's a connected system which everywhere is permeated by these three phase spaces, the abiotic, the biotic, and the noetic, that the universe as a whole is susceptible to intervention on the part of man's mind. And that, in fact, that is the very reason for existence of human beings, is to play this role as a co-creator, to continually expand and drive the self-conscious development of the universe as expressed through the scientific and cultural activity of man. I mean, the other point that Lynn keeps making is that what's going to be required as part of this identity shift in the United States and the world is going to demand a return back to the classical tradition in music, in arts, in the plastic arts, etc. Because part of why people are unable to grasp these ideas as they need to be is because of just the sheer degradation of the population, the collapse of culture, the coming into existence during the, really right after World War II, but most emphatically during the 68er period of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the hippie movement, all this stuff, where everything just became basically you're an animal, your role on this planet is to seek pleasure, avoid pain. It was really free trade economics taken to the extreme of cultural depravity. And because of that, people, young people particularly, have no sense of what productivity is. They have no connection to the past. And they don't understand beauty. They don't know what it is to be a beautiful human soul. And so part of the drive and the transformation is going to be required is going to be a transformation of culture, a return and then and further development of this classical tradition.
And Ouyang, let me just ask you, because you've done some, I think you published a paper on this, you've done some work on this. What are the implications of this approach to the development of new resources and the expansion of available resources for man? Because one of the arguments is if you really think about what you're talking about, increasing the potential relative population density, I think we can make the argument fairly easily by flying from Houston to Los Angeles that we're not going to run out of space, but they argue we're going to run out of raw materials. What are the implications of this approach to science on the so-called raw material base for human life?
Yeah, I think that's where you get a clear idea that what we're discussing are not is not, you know, a nice option for humanity, but it's actually an imperative. That the basic principle of physical economy is the fact that human beings have to overcome the rate of depletion of what any given existing technology defines as your resource base. So in this sense, the discussion of what does infrastructure mean on Mars, what does the question of space travel actually give us, it gives us a necessary way to deal with these things, because all of a sudden we realize that we've been in a womb this whole time. And now, taking ourselves out of that, it becomes clear exactly what the parameters of all those things we didn't have to think about really are. Now, among those things, you know, the basic raw materials is, you have one thing where you have huge, you know, most of the concentrations, the best concentrations of existing raw materials that we've used have been depleted. There's some unused concentrations which have to be developed in Siberia, and the only way that's going to happen is if you have large-scale infrastructure development to support the populations that can utilize those. At a higher level, you want to actually create through fusion, through the manipulation of isotopes, you want to be able to create the materials you need rather than relying on the products, you know, the sort of products of accumulation of the biosphere. But redefining infrastructure at this point becomes a necessity, because we have to realize, you know, as you go into space, there's all kinds of anomalous effects that make you realize how little we understand about the environment on Earth. For example, the role of electromagnetism, the role of the Earth's magnetic field on bone loss, on other functions of the central nervous system. These become questions that aren't optional when you're trying to support human beings in space. But if you adopt that standpoint now, it clarifies exactly what the role of infrastructure on Earth is. Is that you're literally building the environment, and you realize, you know, human beings, it's a sort of a myth that human beings have ever really lived off the Earth, quote unquote, in any simple sense. I mean, the only way you can do that is at a very low and limited level of culture that's ultimately unsuccessful. I mean, you go back as far as you can go back, even in the history of agriculture, you've had a necessity to intervene in the biosphere, to intervene to maintain the fertility of the soil, to intervene to maintain the direction of water supplies and other things, intervene with the, you know, breeding of new species of livestock and other things. You realize that is our relationship to nature. It's never been anything else. So it's not as if we're talking about optional choices here. But the only way you're going to overcome the rate of depletion to maintain a larger and more successful population is to adopt the standpoint that infrastructure is not building on top of some existing environment and trying to stop the decay of that environment. It's building that environment up into a higher state as a whole.
Now, I'm sorry, did you have more to say?
No, just the difference between the idea that you're, you know, instead of sticking something on to try to, you know, stop the bleeding, sticking something on to conserve resources, we're acting to shape the environment both, you know, through the biosphere, but at a higher level. And, you know, the clearest expression of this is what you have to do when you go outside of the biosphere. Then you get a real sense of what it is that human beings are actually doing to maintain human life. We create our own environment.
Now, as we speak of these kinds of programs, it's clear that there have been, particularly in Russia, but in other countries, efforts to come up to this kind of conception. In China, you've got major infrastructure projects. Lynn and Helga LaRouche reintroduced the idea of the Eurasian land bridge following the collapse of the Soviet system. India is going aggressively with nuclear power. Is there a community of scientists around the world that are open to this kind of perspective and that, that we're working on organizing, either Cody or Ouyang?
Yeah, I mean, there are. That's part of the idea of what our team is involved in right now is you, for example, have a number of people at NASA who are given make work because the mandate for, you know, the scientists right now is how do you model the flow of, you know, some pollutant in the air, some quote-unquote pollutant, or some other, you know, they're chasing down these sort of ridiculous projects instead of being given a real mission, which is to say, well, how do you actually map this system as a whole? How do you understand it functionally as a system? Those are the types of people that we want to be able to provoke with, you know, with our material, to be able to expand it, engage in a dialogue on the content.
Now, what are we planning on putting out from the basement? Because this is, I mean, what we've covered in the first 50 minutes is highly provocative. It's fresh, it's a new approach, and this is, of course, what I would say has been implicit in what Lyndon LaRouche has been working on for 50 years, starting with his economic forecasting. But it is quite a lot to grasp. So what are we planning to do, both with the LaRouche Pack website, with videos, with papers? What are you guys up to?
Well, we've got a number of things in the works. I can't say exactly what the first thing to come out will be or what the totality of everything that will come out will be. But right now we're looking at a couple of different videos that we would start to, that we're working on and starting to map out what would go into those with a number of animations that get at things like the global water cycle, that get at things like the evolutionary development of the biosphere and the role of man into that. All of this to set up some very detailed and hopefully animated work-throughs of exactly what the NWAPA project entails. One thing we're looking at right now is something you'd have a kind of a 3D animated map where you would travel through from Alaska down into Mexico. You would actually travel through the routes and the projects that go into the NWAPA program. And so something like that where there would be a certain kind of interactive map and walkthrough of all the projects, what's entailed, what the potential is through it. You'd see things like the changes that would occur in the biosphere as you brought water, the changes that would occur in the weather systems and weather patterns. So some series of animations, movies, videos that really start to paint the picture of what this means, but situated in the proper epistemological setting and ontological perspective. So right now we're just sort of mapping that out. People are pulling together the research. We're trying to contact the right people to get the necessary data that we need. So that's all in the works now, and you know, we hope to have, by this time next week, something prepared to present at one level, and then over the course of the next weeks, putting out more and more material that that really get at exactly what this program is and what it entails.
I think people can just keep... Go ahead.
They haven't seen, I was just going to say, if people haven't seen the weekly report from this last week, which was, I think, put up on Wednesday, but it featured Mr. LaRouche, and his discussion, really, like in the first half hour, 40 minutes of that, of laying out the principle of infrastructure, the role of NWAPA as a driver, as a science driver, and as really forcing mechanism for a new conception of economics. That's something that everybody should look at because that gives a very clear perspective on exactly why this intervention is needed now at this point. It's not something that's a sort of, you know, window dressing. But it's the intervention that has to be made, given the fact that you have a real-time collapse. I mean, LaRouche's forecast has come true. It's this summer we're seeing the disintegration of the country. And if Obama is out, then the image of the post-Obama world has got to be the image that LaRouche paints in this discussion of how you're actually now going to unleash this latent power in the United States, particularly among, you know, these unemployed, skilled engineers, scientists, and technicians, to begin to reshape the actual, the economic, the physical, the cultural geography of the country.
And that's on the weekly report for this last week, a dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche. And I would suggest that people listening to this program go regularly to the LaRouchePack.com website, because we'll be having updates. We also have some of the older material, which I just watched one of the things you did, Ouyang, about a year ago on the extraterrestrial imperative, which was still absolutely fresh and new. So there's a lot of material there that people can get. Now, also, coming up, I think in a week or so, your colleague Sky Shields from the basement is going to be out in San Francisco. His brother, Summer Shields, is the write-in candidate to run that two or three or four-faced Nancy Pelosi out of the Congress. Summer's running in the district of Pelosi in San Francisco, and he's sponsoring a town meeting this next week, I believe it is, or maybe it's in 2 weeks. But go to the Summer Shields for Congress website, and you can get the information on that. And watch on our websites, because there'll be more features on this. I'm sure Lynn will have more to say. Cody, you have anything to add? We've got just a little over 3 minutes to go.
I'll just make one last point that Lynn made to a group of young people on Wednesday night out here, where he said, look, except for those who are exceptionally evil, who have embraced evil, like Barack Obama, that other than those types, every human being has some idea, some image of themselves, which is a better person. And they desire for that. They want to be that better person. But they don't get there because they make compromises. They make compromises so they can have comfort. They make compromises because they have fears. They make compromises because they want security. And we're at a point now where it's those kinds of compromises which have an existential effect on mankind. He said, look, every one of us has to now confront those compromises in ourselves and overcome them so that we can realize what is absolutely necessary now, which is the removal of Obama, the implementation of this Glass-Steagall standard, so that we can, on the next day, move to implement this very necessary NAWAPA program so that mankind can move forward and avoid this dark age crisis. But it really does come down to each individual confronting those compromises in themselves, overcoming them, and really realizing that better person, which every person has an image of in the back of their mind. And so I think it's important just to realize this is a subjective question for all of us if we're going to achieve what's necessary now.
And Ouyang, you brought up the cuts going into the space program. It was this week in Houston that word went out that the Constellation Project is going to be shut down. This is a head-to-head fight with Obama, and the Congress is running away. They're compromising. Do you have any thoughts on this? We have less than 2 minutes, but...
Yeah, this is a guy who said, you know, why do we need to go back to the moon? We've already been there. People don't understand, you know, if people get that mentality, then they'll realize why it is that you have no possibility of any kind of recovery of the United States, any kind of a decent future, as long as Obama's in office. And, you know, maybe, people might need to develop their own mental images for the post-Obama world to make it something that's tangible. I mean, maybe it's, you know, what's going to be the effect of being able to go to the new concert hall that's built in some new city in the center of Montana, or something like that. You know, those possibilities are only, you know, that's got to be the sort of motivation for people to realize that you don't just act against some present evil. You realize that the present evil is an impediment to a future that has to be actively brought into being. And that's what ultimately this NAWAPA project is. It's an image of how you're going to bring that future into being.
I have another image quickly. Keisha Rogers, who's the Democratic candidate for Congress, who is fighting to expand NASA, and now her campaign is incorporating this call for NAWAPA. So, Cody and Ouyang, thank you very much for joining us today. I hope people take some time to think about these ideas. In a sense, this really should be self-evident, but it's not, because of the destruction of education carried out by the Russellites and the Zeus faction that Cody identified. So we will continue to update people on this project. Get on our website. Help us bring this post-Obama period into existence right now. So until next week, we'll be back at 3 p.m. next Saturday with the LaRue Show. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, thanks. We'll see you.
Okay.